committee will come to order again. Thank you, everyone, for being here. We're going to change the order a little bit today. We're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 332, just to keep our council on his toes here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 332 is a bill that would amend the Oregon Evidence Code, and it would extend physician-patient privilege to confidential communications made between patients and dentists. It essentially changes the definition of physician to include dentists.
Thank you. We have... five witnesses. We have Jane Paulson, Cheryl Edwards, and Peggy. Oh, okay. We'll start off with Dr. Robert Staley as our first witness. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Ringo.
Yeah, he's already passed them out. Oh, I thought he had.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Dr. Robert Staley, and I am an oral surgeon dentist for 30 years and also an attorney for the past 10 years. And I have been involved in both, and currently am still in practice in oral surgery and also practice law. To be honest with you, in 30 years of practice, I never realized that a dentist was not included in the privilege with patients. I've handed out a copy of my dental chart that a patient fills out when they come into the office for their medical history, and I circled some of the questions that would be of concern to patients as far as confidentiality is concerned. And as you can see, this form is necessary for us to find a history of a medical history for a patient as it relates to dentistry. And you can see that some of the questions that are of interest would be medications that a patient is currently taking or has taken. Are they pregnant? Are they taking birth control pills, which can have significant effects on antibiotic therapy, HIV exposure, sexually transmitted diseases? This stuff is recorded on the chart, but oftentimes I'll question a patient and receive information verbally, which I always assumed was confidential and really part of the dental record. Most importantly, over the years, I have had numerous patients, usually young, oftentimes young girls, that have specifically said to me, you know, I'm taking birth control pills, but you won't tell my parents, will you? And they're out in the waiting room. Or I've actually had several females tell me that they're pregnant and they don't want their parents to know. I've also had teenagers tell me that they have a drug history, and again, they don't want their parents to know. I may not agree with this personally as far as what they're doing, but I have always abided by the expectation as a healthcare provider to maintain this confidentiality. And again, I always just assumed that this privilege did exist the same as a physician. I know in the legislative bills in the past and in some court proceedings that dentists have been included generically with physicians. So anyhow, I'm asking and just testifying my feeling and belief that dentists should be included, that the privilege should be extended to include dentists.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought this document about the patient information, because my only concern with this bill was I couldn't imagine how dentists could pick up confidential information when the people have all that stuff in their mouth and can't even talk. Having had many recent one-way conversations with my dentist. Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, I'm going to call up somebody who has not signed up, Bill Gallagher. Tom Gallagher, I'm sorry. you don't have to do your talk show routine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The famous talk show host is not here. It's just me, Tom Gallagher, representing the newspaper publishers, and we have no objection. We always thought that no medical personnel were included in this records exemption, so this is fine.
Thank you very much. I wanted to hear that from you. We have four people signed up, Jane Paulson, Cheryl Edwards, Peggy Ferralier, and April Love, all in favor. And Jane Paulson has noted that she has written testimony. I like this bill a lot. I'm prepared to move on this bill. If there's somebody who desperately wants to speak, please come forward now. Otherwise, we will just move along with this bill. Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 332, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 332.
Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 332 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 332 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Ringo, would you like to carry this bill?
Be glad to.
Thank you. Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 89. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 89 would create two offenses, custodial sexual misconduct in the first degree and custodial sexual misconduct in the second degree, the latter a misdemeanor, the former a felony. It is effective upon passage. It applies to sexual contact between corrections staff and inmates.
Thank you. We have several people signed up for this. We'll start with Stan Cherniak. Cherniak. I should know it by now. It's Cherniak, right?
Cherniak.
Cherniak, all right.
Chair Burdick and members of the Judiciary Committee, good afternoon. My name is Stan Cherniak, and I'm the Assistant Director of Operations for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide for you today information on Senate Bill 89, which deals with custodial sexual misconduct. Universally, sexual contact between staff and inmates in correctional settings is considered to be unacceptable. Inmates are absolutely dependent on staff for basic life needs, and in addition, they're dependent on staff for distribution of privileges, cell assignments, work assignments, and just about everything that goes on within a prison by way of privileges or other parts of institutional life. Because of the inherent power differential, there can be no consensual sexual contact between those who supervise and those that are in their custody. It's very similar to the same type of a situation that you have with adults and children in that there can be no consensual sexual activity between adults and children. We take the same position in regard to sexual activity between our staff or staff or contractors and those that are in our custody. There are official professional misconduct statutes that do apply to this type of behavior. While it is a crime, these are misdemeanor level charges and have proven to be ineffective, to be an ineffective deterrent. That is why the Department of Corrections proposes raising the sanctions to the felony level. I should also like to add that throughout the country, Oregon and Vermont are the only two states that do not have a felony statute in pertaining to sexual activity between those who are incarcerated and those who are in control of the custody. That's why the Department of Corrections has requested litigation to criminalize sexual intercourse or sexual contact between staff and those in custody or under supervision. Consent of the other person of sexual contact is not a defense. This bill would make any sexual intercourse between a staff member or contractor and the person in custody or under supervision a Class C felony. A conviction would be punishable by a maximum of 5 years imprisonment $125,000 fine or both. Lesser sexual contact between a staff member, contractor, or a volunteer, any person in custody or under local supervision will become a Class A misdemeanor and would be, if convicted, punishable by a maximum of 1 year imprisonment or a $6,250 fine or both. This law would protect persons who are, one, confined or detained in a correctional facility as defined in Oregon Revised Statute 162.135, including the Department of Corrections and all of its facilities, the Oregon Youth Authority and their facilities, county jails, and the Oregon State Hospital Forensics Unit. Participants in an inmate or offender work crew or work release program would also be protected, as would those who are under probation, parole, post-prison supervision, or other forms of conditional supervised release. This bill would cover perpetrators who are employed by or under contract with a state or local agency that operates a correctional facility in which other persons are confined or detained, employed by an agency that is responsible for supervising the other person, in a work crew or work release program, or on probation, parole, post-prison supervision, or other form of conditional or supervised release. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? I'm sure you'll be standing by in case questions
come
up.
Yes, I will.
Thank you very
much.
Next, we're going to take Jason Barber and John Powell. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jason Barber. I'm the Assistant Director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section within the Department of Justice. I'm going to be extremely brief, just showing up here to get on the record in support of the bill. And having done that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. John?
Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Madam Chair, I have two people from the Marin County Sheriff's Office here. If it would please you, I'd like them to come up now and present their testimony with me.
That would be wonderful. Yeah. If they'd like to join you. I don't think I have
Greg
my
Olson and Mike sign up. Wilkerson.
Greg Wilson and
Greg Olson.
Greg Olson. That's all right.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association endorses the provisions of Senate Bill 89, and we have been assured by the DOC that the definition of correctional facility found in 163.135 would cover county facilities, incarceration facilities. Mr. Olson and Mr. Wilkerson will expand on testimony and present at least in concept at least one other area that they might like to explore in terms of an amendment to this bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, Madam Chair. Mike Wilkerson, Undersheriff at the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm here not only with the Sheriff's Office, but also representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors as well. So I wear that hat. Many of you may not know that Marion County Sheriff's Office is one of nine county sheriff's offices that actually not only perform law enforcement services, but we also do custodial, meaning we operate a jail and a work center, and then we run parole and probation or community corrections. So it's kind of like a full meal deal here in Salem. You know, we have all three of those components. In retrospect, I wish this bill would have been in effect last year. We had a corrections deputy that had inappropriate sexual involvement with two inmates in Marion County, and unfortunately, like earlier testimony was offered, the only thing that we could come up with was the official misconduct, which is a misdemeanor. So I'm here to advocate on behalf of OACCD, the Community Corrections Directors, that we are supportive of the bill. And I'll then turn it over to Undersheriff Greg Olson with he'll maybe elaborate on a modification regarding the enforcement component.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Other questions before we move on? Thank you. Okay. Senator Whitson.
Chair Burdick, Mr. Olson, is there currently any duty to report if among the staff if one staff member observes improper conduct of another staff member regarding sexual misconduct?
Yes, sir, there is. Yeah, in this particular situation, I was referring to this particular officer or deputy was in a private confined area with two females, and unfortunately there was no witnesses to the effect.
And follow up,
please.
Is there any effort to create a reporting system between law enforcement agencies where when the individual has had sanctions before to prevent them from being employed in other corrections facilities?
There'd be a criminal background check.
And then also DPSST would decertify.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be allowed to be.
Senator, I'm Greg Olson, Marion County Sheriff's Office, Undersheriff. Under DPSST rules, we would notify DPSST if someone was terminated for cause, and they would decertify them, take their certification away, and they wouldn't be allowed to reapply for certification if they'd been decertified.
Okay, thank you. One more follow-up. The other question was, is there any protection from retaliation if one employee informs the management or whoever is appropriate of a misconduct? Is there any protection from retaliation from other employees?
Well, certainly, Senator, there is protections, but it's an expectation because of their job that they would report that kind of activity. It's if they witness a crime, they need to report it.
Senator Wilson, let me break in here and ask Mr. Wilkerson. You mentioned that there was a duty to report. Where does that duty come from?
One is that when, in fact, law enforcement or anybody that's certified, they have an oath. It's called an ethics oath that they swear by, that they will uphold and report any misconduct and a right to protect those individuals. So that's one of the avenues that we do. And then we, as our own agency, go ahead and have our own ethical conversations anytime that we swear anybody in our own department and outline what the expectations are at that point in time.
And what are the consequences if someone fails to do that under your ethics system?
Well, we have been known to terminate individual employees who fail to come forth with information and or basically are untruthful when asked questions about that.
Okay, but to your knowledge, there's nothing in the statutes that requires them to do that?
I'm not personally aware of anything in the statutes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Whitsitt, does that address your question? Thank you. Okay. Mr. Olson, I believe you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greg Olson. I'm an Undersheriff of Marion County Sheriff's Office Enforcement Division. I have all the law enforcement functions with our office, and one of the pieces that we'd like you to consider in this bill is also consider law enforcement custody, and that means prior to arrival at a correctional facility, maybe, but when this person would be in custody of a law enforcement officer.
So when they're in transit from being transferred from one jail to another or from jail to prison.
Or in custody, arrested on the street and being transported to a police facility and at a police facility for an interview.
Okay. That's a good point. All right. And that's it?
That's all I have. Thank you.
Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we will take Senator Pozanski.
If Mr. Olson or Mr. Wilkinson, if we put in custody, that would suffice, wouldn't it? Once they're in custody of law enforcement,
detained
or in custody, could catch it. Okay.
Can you have a seat? One more question, because I wanted to ask you another question as well, and that is, what would your view be about inserting some reporting requirement in the statute? I just wanted to run that by and see what you
think. That'd be wonderful. Yeah. It's an expectation of our employees, but it'd certainly be great to have that legislatively also.
There may be some issues there on labor as to what has been contracted and stuff because of internal and just that. I don't know if we want to, without getting LC opinion on this, would want to include that, because I know for the police commission for Eugene, there's some things that we looked at, but they say we always have to take in consideration whatever has been placed in the contract that's been bargained by the bargaining unit. Not that we wouldn't think it's appropriate, but at the same time, we might be going in an area that could cause us to have a significant issue.
Well, and that, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've been scanning the room looking for the corrections officer's representative and don't see her. But I just wanted to, as long as you're here, to see what your position was on that. So I appreciate that very much.
I'll speak for Mary if you want me to.
Mary would love that. Thank you very much. Okay, next we will take Heidi Evans and Dina Marshall. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity to allow us to testify in favor of SB 89. My name is Heidi Evans. Sitting next to me is Dina Marshall. We're both Oregonians, and we're voluntary leaders for Amnesty International USA. I'm the Oregon Legislative Coordinator, and Ms. Marshall is the Oregon Coordinator for the Stop Violence Against Women campaign. Amnesty applauds Director Max Williams, his staff, and AFSCME for their efforts to get a bill addressing custodial sexual misconduct introduced this legislative session. But for reasons that I'd like to discuss briefly, the bill as introduced, we feel, does not go far enough. Specifically, amendments are needed, one, to create a duty to report custodial sexual misconduct on the part of employees of correctional facilities or the vendors of correctional facilities who know it is occurring. Secondly, we feel there's an amendment needed to create a reporting system. Who are those people going to report to? What's that process going to be? As well as a fair and meaningful investigation process. What will happen to the report once it is gathered? And protections put into place to ensure that those who are reporting are not the victims of retaliation later on. And then last, an amendment for same-sex searches unless there is an emergency. Custodial sexual misconduct is a problem in Oregon, and we feel that these amendments could significantly reduce that problem. In 1990,
let me interrupt here and ask you just your opinion here. If there was, if it does prove to be not possible to have a reporting system for reasons that we don't control in this committee, would you think that it would be a positive step just simply to to provide protection from retaliation?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And we have your written testimony, and it's quite lengthy, so we don't need to hear the whole thing.
Sure.
If you could just kind of give us the cliff notes on that. Thank you.
Will do. In 1999, it was reported by the union to the House Judiciary Committee that there, in the past few years from that period, there were 36 incidences of custodial sexual misconduct that they were aware of. 30 of those were reported by other officers or staff of the correctional facilities. That means roughly 20% that came to light not because of that. And we feel that there is a code of silence. There is information in the written testimony from the GAO and nationally indicating that's a problem. There have unfortunately been a number of high-profile cases here in Oregon, not just involving the DOC with the Coffee Creek, but also with youth and the Oregon Youth Authority involving sexual misconduct with young male minors, that an affidavit from a detective at the state police indicated that coworkers were aware that that was going on and didn't report it. So we feel very strongly that there is a need for a duty to report, and that duty to report has some teeth in it. And then what we did was we followed the statutes that are on the books with respect to the duty to report for other professionals, such as lawyers, clergy, medical doctors, etc., to have to report child abuse if they have a reasonable belief. Working with the DOC, we recognize that that is a very low threshold, so we've changed it to if the officer knows that the behavior is going on. We'd also like to see protections for those people so that there is no retaliation, like you, Madam Chair, mentioned. Another amendment that we are seeking is that there be a reporting process, an internal investigation, and non-retaliation. Also, that cavity searches, that the state agencies, there's an exception for cavity searches in the bill, and we're simply asking that the state agencies over the correctional facilities set forth in writing what their policy is when a cavity search would happen, so that there's more forethought to that, and there's less chance that would be used as an abusive nature.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you want to speak as well?
Sure. Thank you. I just would like to reiterate our support for this bill and the need for...
Do you identify yourself?
Oh, thank you. My name is Dina Marshall. I am the state coordinator for the Stop Violence Against Women campaign here in Oregon. Just briefly about the Stop Violence Against Women campaign. It's a six-year campaign, national in the United States and also internationally. The primary focus here in Oregon is to work toward enacting custodial sexual misconduct legislation. Reiterating again, also, Oregon and Vermont are really the only two states in the country that do not yet have these laws on the books. And the goal here is to really bring this state up to speed with the rest of the country. The three amendments that Heidi discussed for the duty to report, appropriate care and redress with non-retaliation protections and same-sex searches, I really think would help this law tremendously. And in particular, the same-sex searches, we understand, is already a practice in the Department of Corrections, but it has not yet been established as a rule. And we also understand that on a federal level, the Transportation Security Administration conducts same-sex searches. So there is a sort of compelling evidence on a federal level to have same-sex searches on a state level as well. Other than that, I just want to say thank you, and we support this amendment or this bill with particular amendments.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Senator Walker.
I just want to say I like these amendments. I think they're important.
Thank you.
I'm just horrified by what I'm reading in your statement, Ms. Evans. These cases, they're disgusting. And I just want to thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Even though she's very, very tardy, for the sake of continuity, at this point I'd like to call Mary Botkin. Even though she should not be rewarded for tardiness. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead if you want to testify, but specifically we need to get your views on the mandatory reporting issue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I apologize profusely for being so tardy. As luck would have it, our union sent somebody here from Washington, D.C., and I kept looking at my watch at lunch saying, I have to get back now. I have to get back.
I don't know.
They have a different time level than we do. Let me just start
by... Would you put your name on the record?
Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We have been working with the department on this bill and this issue for some time through the interim, trying to sort of work through what we needed to address and what we could agree to and what they felt they needed to do, what they need to do as the employer. And we think the bill really does address sort of what it is we are most concerned about, which is inappropriate sexual contact between inmates and staff. And let me just say for the record that our union does not believe there is ever an appropriate sexual relationship between an inmate and staff. that the minute our members put a uniform on or take a job at the Department of Corrections, inmates are off limits. Period. Having said that, we do not support Amnesty International's amendments. We do not think that it should be a crime to not report something you think might have happened between two people that you did not in the first person witness. And we know from professional experience that prior to this bill being introduced, that every reported contact that was made by colleagues telling on each other. And it's really quite simple to understand this whole process. Officers and staff inside the institution understand that once there's an inappropriate relationship between their clients and themselves, that the security of the institution and therefore their safety is at risk. And so they are very willing to sort of tell when they know that there's relationships going on. We would not support the idea of same-sex searches as, quote, the law. And let me tell you why. First of all, we do same-sex searches when it is feasible. We do it at all times when it is feasible. There are emergency situations where it may not be feasible, where there needs to be a search by an officer of an inmate who may not share the same sex. To eliminate our ability to perform those searches in that situation would be to place the officer's safety at risk. We need to make sure that they're not armed with anything. I mean, it's just that simple. And it also places the inmates at risk. I mean, if we're dealing with a suicidal inmate, we need to know what they have on their person in order to take any potential weapons away from them. I can tell you that having gone through or watched some of the training that the officers go through with opposite-sex searches, they are very non-intrusive. And they are done in a manner which is as comfortable as is possible for both the inmate and the staff person. Male staff persons, for example, are not allowed to do open-handed searches of a female inmate. They have to do... You know, I'm sure there are technical terms for this. I just don't know what they are. But they have to do the back of the hand. They can't do none of this kind of stuff, if you will. I know that there are people behind me laughing right now. But, you know, this is not my field of work, and so I just have to kind of explain to you what I know about it. I know that they don't, I mean, they're just very careful in how they handle themselves when they are doing opposite-sex searches, and it is not done as a regular occurrence, but rather it is done when there is no other officer quickly or immediately available and search needs to occur right away.
Okay. You addressed the issue of mandatory reporting and your concerns about that. Is there anything in your collective bargaining agreements that would prohibit or make it impossible to have mandatory reporting?
There's nothing in our collective bargaining agreement at this time that would limit the mandatory reporting. Madam Chair, let me just say that our people are, quote, mandatory reporters. So if they know something for sure, then they have to tell.
On what authority are they mandatory reporters?
Under the broad authority of as being a peace officer. Peace officers are all mandatory reporters. And they are classified as peace officers under the law.
Okay, so what you're saying is once this is defined as a crime, then they become...
They become a mandatory reporter for what they know has occurred or what they have witnessed. And again, I apologize to the committee. I have not seen the latest version of Amnesty International's amendments, but the version that I did see indicated that was if you knew something might have occurred. I mean, just it felt very sloppy to me. It was sort of like, well, I might know that somebody's with somebody else, but I don't really know, but I'm going to report it anyway.
But and what that you're saying is that under your existing policies and procedures, if someone has direct knowledge, not
they have to tell.
Or whatever, they have to tell.
They have to tell.
Senator Pazansky.
Madam Chair, my point earlier was not about this level of reporting, but I think there can be that duty based on just what the employer wants them to do. It was basically reporting outside as to the disciplinary action that may be taken outside of the agency.
Correct. And mandatory, so, statutory mandatory.
Or, well, no, a concern of reporting it to what is actually related to DPSST or whoever else. I mean, there's some type of report that's got to be filed with them, but I don't know if we want to be articulating what has to be reported, because there may be issues under contract, at least when the when there's disciplinary action taken against a officer in Eugene because of their bargaining unit, there's the city is limited as to what they can say. It's founded or unfounded. You can't go into specifics. And I think that's pretty general with most collective bargaining. So I don't know what my concern was, that if we try to put something in statute requiring some type of reporting to some outside agency or authority as to what it might be, mm-hmm. I think that's where we have to walk very softly and make sure we're right. on sound ground. Not it's not the part of an employee reporting another employee. I think that's would be just reporting a crime.
Right. Well, and I think it's that. Important to sort of draw a line or a distinction here that if you are a Department of Corrections employee and you decide that, you know, I'm not going to tell people who they can love. I'm just going to tell you you can't love them if you're supervising them. You know, and you have to make choices. And I think we're all sort of in that boat sometimes where you have to make choices. And if you want to be with a person and that person is an inmate and you are a staff person for the department, then the choice is whether or not you want to have a relationship with that inmate or if you want to work there. And as harsh as it may sound, after having met with many, many of our members, they feel very strongly that once they made the choice to be with an inmate, they can no longer be an employee of the department. And, you know, were it left to my own devices, I might feel personally a little differently than that about it, but I am representing our membership's views right now, and our membership's views are that you don't get to have a relationship with inmates. Period. End of the discussion.
Okay. The other question I had around this is we discussed this very briefly earlier with a previous witness, and that is the idea of providing protection against retaliation if someone does report. I don't know that that's even been a problem, but if
the union would represent anybody who was felt that they were being retaliated against for reporting something they knew to have happened.
Senator Pazansky.
I also think Bowie has those requirements on the whistleblower, you know, type of approach. So I think there'd be a couple different avenues.
Yeah, I don't.
Well, and we regularly, when we have a situation like this with a whistleblower, we regularly not only file a grievance with the employer, but we also file a Bowie claim or EEOC, whatever is appropriate, so that none of the remedies available to a member are ignored, and those cases are only dismissed once we are satisfied that the person for who the claim was filed has been properly represented and protected in the work site.
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. First of all, Ms. Bodkin, you object to same-sex searches because you say that's not feasible. You do it in an emergency, but most of the time you try to accommodate. Well, this amendment, which you said you've not seen, says searches must be conducted by an officer of the same sex of the person being searched unless an emergency exists and no officer of the same sex is available. I think that's exactly what you say you do now.
Would you like to come forward? You're jumping out of your seat.
Thank you, Chair Burke.
I'm dying to come up here. Well, could I give a couple points of clarification?
If you identify yourself for the record.
Members of the committee. she took my notes, too.
If you identify yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm sorry. Stan Zerniak, Assistant Director for Operations, Department of Corrections. The first thing I wanted to clarify that the Department of Corrections does have a code of conduct that requires that staff report unethical conduct or conduct that's against the law. That any violation of that can and often does result in dismissal from service. The other thing I wanted to clarify is that in the area of searches, our policy requires that female inmates are pat searched by female officers except in extreme emergencies when there's no other alternative and we absolutely have to do a search. And those kind of situations are almost never. In fact, I can't even think of one in my entire 30-plus years career that we've ever had to do that. The other point that's real important to separate and understand, I think, is that we're talking about pat-down searches when it comes to what I just described. In regards to strip searches where inmates have to take their clothing off to be searched, those are same-sex searches, whether it's male or female. So only males can strip search a male, and only females can strip search a female. The only circumstance where we would have a cross-gender search would be a pat-down search in the case of a female on a male. And that's our current policy.
Female on a what?
Female on a male inmate.
Oh.
But female inmates are, in fact, only pat searched by female employees, female correctional officers.
Thank you for clarifying that. And I see. Now, see if Ms. Botkin a bit on time, you could have come up together. Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I had one other question. Because I'm confused, Ms. Botkin and maybe Mr. Zerniak can correct my confusion or clear it up. You said that all of your folks are mandatory reporters. Well, I know about the mandatory reporter law with regard to child abuse, but I didn't know there was a mandatory reporter law with regard to inmates. And I think that's what the issue was here, that they wanted a mandatory law to, reporter law to require someone to report this kind of issue.
Madam Chair, the only thing that I would suggest is that we tighten up the language then, that it has to be first-hand knowledge, that it can't be sort of something you thought you might have known about that might have happened with somebody at some time maybe.
Well, Madam Chair, my concern about that is under the child abuse reporting law, you don't have to have first-hand knowledge. You have a suspicion, and the suspicion is pretty strong, and you get training and understanding how to define whether your suspicion is good enough to warrant a complaint. And so I think you can do the same thing in this situation. You can get training to understand, well, what is real and what is reportable and what isn't. I mean, your scenario there is I heard about it over coffee that somebody 2 weeks ago might have had sex with so-and-so, but I'm not sure. And, you know, okay, fine. Do you really know? I don't know, but does it rise to the level of reporting it to a supervisor? Probably. And you're mulling that over and moving your head and thinking about it. Mr. Zerniak, can you tell me what the procedures are within the facility?
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, currently the Code of Conduct does require that, again, unethical conduct or conduct that's against the law or against our rules does have to be reported. If we get indications that an employee has not reported when they are required to report, we do an investigation, and if we have enough evidence that we feel we can take disciplinary action, we do in fact do that. And I'm not sure if I answered your question. I suspect I didn't.
Well, Madam Chair, I just still was confused about Ms. Botkin saying that you're mandatory reporters. Mandatory reporters for what?
I believe that the mandatory reporting extends to abuse, not just of children, but of seniors and of anybody. I mean,
well,
you know,
maybe I could. Council's looking this up as we speak.
Maybe I'm mistaken.
Yeah, it applies to children, seniors, and but it's not. I don't believe it applies to inmates under the statutory. I think her point was that it's already part of their policies and procedures that they could lose their job. It's not a crime like it is under the statutes, but their employment would be at stake. So the question is, how much enforcement do you need for it?
Right, and I would suspect that Senator Witz had pointed out to me that we also have Oregon Youth Authority people here, and Oregon Youth Authority, those are children, and you would be a mandatory reporter on
that. But they are as well.
But the inmates, unless you're a senior, unless you're a child.
Which we'll have more and more with ballot measure 11.
Yeah, I think so. Unless you're one of those two bookends, you don't fall under the mandatory reporter statute.
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
That's close.
No, I have a little more hair.
No cigar.
I don't remember if somebody made the point that if you criminalize the activity, that peace officers are mandatory reporters of crimes, all crimes. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but that's what someone who testified said, that it currently they would not because this is not a crime. But once you make it, if you criminalize the act, then peace officers are mandatory reporters of all crimes.
Okay, I think we're going to put this issue aside now and do a little research in this. Before you step down, I wanted to just ask you very quickly, the suggestion came up earlier to expand this bill to apply to prisoners who are in any kind of custody, like on their way somewhere or between arrest, and you would support
that? I think, yes, Madam Chair, again, Mary Bodkin, I think it makes sense that the minute people are in custody that they should be, we really do think that people who are in custody ought to be treated with some level of respect, and they ought to be kept safe, and they ought not to be in fear of their personal safety or dignity. There's no value in that.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Again, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. And I'll be around.
All right. Thank you very much. Next, we'll take Terry Quinteros, Teresa Huggins, and Bridget Sarah, I think.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Quinteros, and I am the program director. Am I too loud? I am the program director of Crime Survivors for Community Safety, which is a program of the Western Prison Project. I have also worked with domestic and sexual violence survivors in the state of Oregon since 1989. I also used to work with a program known as WICS at Columbia River Correctional Institution, which is a program that helped women transition back to their community after they were, as they were nearing the end of their prison sentence. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 89. What my experience as both a domestic and sexual violence advocate and as an advocate to women who have been in prison has been is that a good majority of the women that I worked with had already been survivors of sexual violence from both their childhood as well as in adulthood. And when that is the situation and someone is in prison, there is a great deal of difference between personal and institutional power that someone who is in prison has as opposed to someone who is working in the prison. As we already heard in testimony given earlier today, people who work in prison, such as the COs, are responsible for handing out work assignments, cell assignments, personal safety, everything that could have to do with someone who is in prison with their daily life. When that is the situation, and you have someone who is perhaps not at a point in their life where they have already dealt with the violence and probably sexual violence that they have experienced in their life beforehand, it would make that impossible, virtually impossible for them to be able to say no to an authority figure if there was any sort of sexual advance made towards them. This is not about love. It's not about building a relationship with someone. It is about someone exerting their power over another human being, and then holding that power over that person. And so in my written testimony that I give you, I often refer to it as rape, because it is rape when someone does not have the opportunity to say no or doesn't feel like they have any options of keeping themselves safe, or that this is their best option for keeping themselves safe in the situation that they're in at the time. And so I strongly support Senate Bill 89. The only part of the amendments that I would be concerned about is, again, with my experience as a domestic and sexual violence advocate, I have seen many bills come down that have been put in place to try and protect the victims or survivors in those particular situations, and that they often get used against them. I would like to make sure that any amendment that says that it makes it a crime for failure to report does not then extend to the people in prison.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize for murdering your name.
No, I'm Teresa Huggins.
Okay, apologize to the next one.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, as I said, I'm Teresa Huggins, and I'm a survivor of rape. I was raped at 12 years old, and I ended up in Hillcrest, and I spent time in jail. And I was later on in my life married to a man that spent time in prison. I'm currently a volunteer here at Crime Survivors for Community Safety, and Senate Bill 89 is of particular importance to me. But I want to say that right now my heart is pounding extremely, because when I heard the conversation about the about the same searches, I've had experience one time when I was arrested with being strip searched by male officers. And I want to say that that was more devastating to me than my rape.
It's okay.
As the officers forcefully took off my clothes, women officers stood and watched, and I hollered to them to please have them stop. So when I heard the discussion regarding it, like I said, my heart is pounding extremely hard. I couldn't stick with my testimony. I didn't write it in my testimony because it is something that's very emotional for me. I didn't report it. I didn't do nothing about it.
How long ago did that happen?
It was about 10 years ago.
I hope we've come beyond that.
Yeah. So do I. I want to say that I wouldn't wish that experience upon anyone. I feel like it was more devastating, or to me it was more devastating than my rape at 12 years old, because when I was 12 and I was raped, everyone told me that you didn't deserve it, Teresa. But no one told me that about when I was strip searched. Even my father told me that, well, that's what happens when you get arrested. And that shouldn't be what happens when you get arrested. And as I said, I didn't do anything about it, because it takes extreme courage to stand up and say no. You know, and it's really difficult to tell somebody how you felt and what happened to you, especially when you're in a position that you think you deserved it. And I feel everyone needs to be held accountable when they harm someone. And I would like to see you add that amendment where same-sex searches are applied. Even to say it again, so we as Oregonians can stand up and say that there's never a time when sexual assault or rape is appropriate, or that someone has to feel bad. If you put it in the laws, then they won't be saying that they'll think twice about the emergencies where a man has to search women. Again, I want to say there was over 7 people in the room. Most of them men, and they were tearing my clothes off.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Welcome.
Chair Burdick. Sorry, members of the committee. Apology accepted. My name is Bridget Sarabi. I'm executive director of Western Prison Project. I'll be very brief. We're strongly in support of this bill for all of the reasons that have been outlined. I've recognize that there are several amendments that have been offered. I believe the ACLU has some additional ones that they will offer. Most of them seem like good ideas. What I would just like to say is that I hope that disagreements over the amendments will not stop the passage of this bill. This bill is too important, and we've waited too long for it. I commend the department for bringing this forward. I commend AFSCME for working on this. Thank you.
Thank you, and I want to assure you this bill will not be stopped, and we will move forward with it. Thank you, and thank you especially for coming.
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
I did want to note, Ms. Sarabi's written testimony, she makes note that Oregon is currently one of only two states that has not passed custodial sexual misconduct legislation. That's pretty alarming.
It is.
What's the other state?
Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Thank you. Okay, now we'll hear from Andrea Meyer.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We have a narrow concern that I think has to do more with language, and I have talked to the Department of Corrections, and I think this isn't really their intent, and I'm happy to work with them. The way this is written, and it's complicated, but I'll try to walk you through, is what we're concerned about is the effect of those who are in work release or outside the institution, and the fact that it may not be a related sexual encounter with someone who's in a supervisory capacity, because it simply has to be someone who's employed by or under contract with a state or local agency. Our concern would be, it may be hypothetical, but potentially real situations where it's someone who could be a janitor or some other role that's not in supervisory authority at all in a work release or probation office. They may not even know that person is under supervision at the time, but through other ways in their life, meet the person and have a consensual relationship. And so we would look to just tighten up the language to get to what I think is the intent when you look at the testimony from the department. They are talking about in roles of supervising, and that's the testimony we heard, the power structure here.
Well, but they're also talking about people in custody. I mean, how could a janitor not know? I mean, they don't have janitors in the can anyway, I don't think.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, we're not speaking to when someone is in custody. It's, if you look at the bill, Section 3 begins, a person commits the crime of custodial sexual misconduct in the first degree if the person, then you drop down to subsection little b, is employed by or under contract with the state or local agency that, and this is the agency is that is responsible for supervising the other person in the work group.
That's correct.
So it doesn't require that it's the employee responsible for supervising. It's just the institution, the agency, which, again, we're not talking. Our concerns are nothing to do with what's going on inside the institutions.
Correct. And I apologize for missing that.
Chair Burdick, I think it's language. The other area that we're concerned about that we'd like to talk to the department a bit more is this marriage defense. As you'll see, in Section 3, marriage between the actor and the other person is an affirmative defense to prosecution under this section. We're sort of troubled. On the one hand, because it doesn't say when the marriage occurs, this whole principle behind the bill is that it can never be consent, even if two individuals are wanting to have a relationship, it can never in this situation be a consensual sexual relationship. One of the things that this reminds us of a little bit is in the past, the ACLU's fought for, historically used to be that if you were married, you could never rape your spouse. It was not an accepted that those crimes couldn't happen by virtue of being married, and we now know that that can, and that is not a defense. As such, it just seems troubling about this very broad defense, and we'd really like to talk to the department a little bit more.
Can we bring Mr. Zerniak back on this marriage thing? Because I can't believe that there wouldn't be some kind of policy in the department over a spouse correction officer guarding their spouse.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, Stan Zerniak, Assistant Director for Operations, Department of Corrections. You're correct, Senator. We have requirements that if you are related to anybody in the institution that you work in fact, even if you have a relative in the Department of Corrections, you have to declare that and let us know that. And then it's our responsibility to make sure that you cannot be assigned to that same institution as your relative.
Senator Pisanski.
I want to follow up on another part that Ms. Meyer brought up. If you had a situation that occurred and then between the officer and the inmate they were going to get married after the fact, how would that impact or would that impact your ability to discipline the officer, he or she, based on the conduct prior to them that occurred prior to their marriage, but the discipline did not take place or wasn't brought to your attention until after the marriage?
Chair Burdick and Senator Pisanski, that's a good question. The Department of Corrections has a very strict policy that prohibits any unprofessional conduct between a correctional officer and an inmate. So that means we literally would not allow that kind of relationship to occur while, you know, unless it had happened before one of the inmate became committed to the Department of Corrections. After they're committed, if there's not that type of relationship, we would not allow that. That would be grounds to be dismissed.
Back as well, because I'm just wondering if we even need this subsection 3 in here. The marriage is an affirmative defense. If the fact that it would ever exist is not allowed into policy anyway. Do you have any comments on that? We're putting you to the test today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, again, for the record, Mary Bodkin with AFSCME. Let me understand the scenario again. Are we married before he goes to prison? So we meet in prison. He's paroled, and we get married.
No.
And while we're in prison, while he's in prison, we have some inappropriate contact.
Which is not allowed by prison law and
right.
Policy.
If you had the conduct occur prior to...
But nobody reported it, and nobody knew about it. It's unlikely that that could occur without somebody knowing about it, number one.
Right. Let me ask another question, if I could, Madam
Please.
Chair. What are the procedure or provisions within the employment of a corrections officer who decides that he or she wants to marry an inmate? In the sense of they met... They decide they want to get married. Is there some protocol? I understand that once they're married, they're going to separate them out from where they're going to work. But is there some knowledge that has to be given or a statement given to management that this relationship is actually occurring prior to all of a sudden we're getting married?
Chair Burdick and Senator Pisanski, again, that relationship would be against our rules. Mm-hmm. That relationship cannot occur. We have very strong language in our code of conduct that spells out you cannot have an unprofessional relationship with an inmate, and we're very strict about that.
Well, my question then is why is it in here in the first place, and who would scream and yell if we took it out?
Chair Burdick, I don't think the Department of Corrections would have a major problem taking that out.
And ACLU would not have a problem?
No, Chair Burdick, we wouldn't.
Okay.
And the DOJ's in the back here for corrections, and it seems like it. There's no jumping up and down, and so it seems like it's okay. This came from the department. I just want to make sure.
Correct.
Because I agree with you. I think we should take it out.
I might be a help. Mm-hmm. I could speak to this very briefly.
Please do. Identify yourself for the record.
Jeff M. Valkenberg, Department of Justice, Counsel for the Department of Corrections. I'm trying to recollect what the purpose was to have the marriage defense. My recollection was that the department asked for it not in relation to any custodial situation, but for a supervision situation in the community where there might be different, an offender from one county and a PO in another county, and there's some chance. I mean, I frankly can't remember all the specifics, but I knew that it was a concern, at least on the community corrections side. And I guess what I'd ask is that Senator Martin or somebody from the department in charge of community corrections, if they have a continuing concern about it, come here and talk to you about it.
Okay, I could actually see a scenario where somebody's on probation in one county, married to a parole officer in another county, but I would think that would be solvable. I mean, if it's an affirmative defense, then that doesn't mean it's going to prevail anyway. So I don't know.
Not under supervision of those people.
Yeah, they're not under supervision.
As I, Mary Botkin again, as I recall, we had a similar bill 2 years ago before the committee, and it may have been the House committee, but regardless, as I recall, the community corrections folks make an effort as well to make sure that that parole staff is not supervising family members or familiars, if you will, for the lack of a better term.
Well, and we already identified the idea that we have to get the supervisory piece in this so that we're not covering incidental people. So let's make sure we structure that amendment carefully so that we can delete this marriage thing without causing any of these unintended consequences. Thank you all very much. Are there other questions of any of these four growing list of witnesses here? Okay, thank you. We have one more witness, Heather Hulanen.
Chair Burdick, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Heather Hulanen. I'm the director of the Sexual Assault Training Institute for the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. And I'm here today on behalf of the task force, very strongly in support of Senate Bill 89. And I think that the conversations have already done a very good job of outlining all of the pros to this piece of potential legislation. And I would just reiterate that the individuals who are institutionalized are particularly vulnerable to sexual violence. And in particular, by staff and employees, by virtue of the accessibility that they have to them. I think that we can also say with confidence that that there's no judge or jury that has ever sentenced a criminal to sexual abuse or violence as a part of their prison sentence, and that having that as a part of a sentence or having that as an assumption of a sentence really sort of flies in the face of the integrity of our criminal justice system. We believe, the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, that criminal acts committed by staff who in fact serve as an arm of the criminal justice system are in absolute contradiction to the most basic standards of the criminal justice system, standards which clearly define what a sexual assault is, what a crime of sexual assault is, but do not differentiate who can be the victim of a sexual crime. Additionally, standards which also work to ensure access to justice for all victims, as well as accountability for criminal behavior. So, in closing, I'd just like to say that we absolutely support Senate Bill 89 as an important way to maintain the integrity of the criminal justice system by recognizing victims of sexual violence, including those that are made vulnerable through incarceration, and by holding all offenders accountable, including and especially those who abuse by way of their positions of power. I'd like to end by saying that we also support the amendments proposed by Amnesty International, but again with that caveat that the mandatory reporting not also be included for inmates themselves.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay, we will, for those who are still hanging in there in the audience, we have identified a number of amendments that we want to get prepared for this bill to make it a better bill, and we will bring it back for a work session at a later time, and we will give adequate notice of that. So with that, I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 89 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 333. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 333 would increase the maximum amount of damages that may be pled in a certain tort actions
for which the court must award attorney's fees to the prevailing party. The current level for this provision is $5,500. This measure would raise that level to $7,500.
Thank you. We'll start off with Cheryl Albrecht and Mark Ginsburg. Welcome.
And members of the committee. My name is Judge Cheryl Albright. I'm a hearings referee for Multnomah County, but I'm here in my personal capacity as a citizen who is able to have my legal needs addressed through statute 20.080. I was in a small car accident. The other party admitted liability, admitted that they were at fault, and it was a small amount of damage, $1,200. I thought it would be a very easy process with a couple of letters exchanged and everything would be fine. However, when the investigator from the insurance company came to look at the damage to my vehicle, he decided that insurance company was only going to pay $292, even though I had two different estimates which had the property damage at more than $1,200. So I really was at a loss of what to do. I didn't know about 20.080 as someone who has worked mostly in the criminal arena in my legal experience. I knew I could hire a lawyer on a contingency basis, but that would mean they'd get $400 of $1,200 and I wouldn't be able to have my car fixed. I could hire a lawyer, but that would cost me a lot of money that I didn't have, and a lawyer probably wouldn't be willing to take on that kind of small case. And also, I knew I could file a small claim suit, but I didn't think I could effectively litigate against an insurance company that was in Arizona. And so I just wanted to say that I was relieved when I did find out about 20.080 and was able to get my injury made whole. I was able to get the $1,200 paid to fix my car, and I was very happy about that. I believe that Senate Bill 333 increases access to justice, not only for people like me who don't know the ins and outs of the insurance system, but also for citizens who don't know anything about the legal system whatsoever. And that's an important goal and would be achieved by this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Ginsburg.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Mark Ginsburg. I'm an attorney up in Portland, Oregon. I was Judge Albrecht's attorney in that matter, but I think the global issue that we're talking about today is the effect of increasing the limit in 20.080 cases is to increase the number of people who have access to justice. Mm-hmm. Very typically, someone will come to me, and the question is, if they have a car crash or a small injury, how can they afford to hire a lawyer? And if they wish to pay me hourly, for an attorney with about 10 years of experience, it's not uncommon for that attorney to be paid hourly in the range of $200 per hour. For a contingency fee case, as Judge Albrecht mentioned, a third of the recovery would not be uncommon. In a case such as hers, a one-third recovery for me would have been $400 worth maybe 2 hours of my time. That wouldn't be a case I could take financially. It's not a viable case. For someone like Judge Albrecht to come to me and hire me hourly would take more hours such that the case is not viable for her. And what 20.080 cases allow is for me to write a letter to the defendant, and usually as a courtesy copy we send a letter to the insurance carrier as well, saying we're going to sue you, and if we do, we're entitled to my attorney's fees as well for this small case. And those attorney's fees can act as a hammer, so that if the case has value and it's something that should be resolved, it typically will resolve quickly. All this bill would do is increase the number of people who have access to justice by allowing them to hire someone like me to help them with a smaller case. I've seen very many cases where we'll see a sort of admitted damages denied liability. It's very classic to see, say, a classic red light intersection where everyone will say, we didn't do it. And so it's a very difficult case for a plaintiff or an injured person to bring. And 20080 gives that person, if they're not injured badly or if their property damage is not very substantial, the opportunity to have access to justice, to have their day in court, to have an arbitrator or a judge or a jury make their findings and make the courts accessible to them. Specifically, I've also seen, we're also talking about a sort of who has access in terms of money. And where we see an insurance carrier on one side, and I know we're going to see some testimony from the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel and some folks on that side of the fence, as it were, the attorneys are paid either hourly or they're staff attorneys for an insurance carrier. The plaintiff's attorneys are paid for the work that they do in this type of case, either for being successful or for hourly, as I've mentioned. And as I've often seen in cases where the fight becomes, was it too much time for the attorney on the plaintiff's side, the injured person's side, we've often seen defense counsel spend more time than plaintiff's counsel. I've seen some written testimony that I expect to be introduced today from Billy Simon. I just want to make a few brief comments on that, and then I'm also very happy to stay to comment on it later. But the testimony that I've seen, the written testimony, which I don't know if it's been handed to you yet, I assume it will be, picks a sort of minor exception to the rule. And then also the case that it mentions, Colby versus Larson, was prior to the enactment of Oregon's Rules of Civil Procedure, the OSCP, and the OSCP under 54E do have what's called an offer of judgment, which can act as a way for both sides to have some equity in resolving cases. So, you know, in my 10 years of practice, I have not seen cases where the plaintiff intentionally runs up a bill in an effort to be the main issue to be the plaintiff's attorney's fees, but I have seen cases where people have come to me with small cases, and because of 20080, I can effectively get them access to justice in our current system. And as I've said before, increasing the amount that the injured person can seek would increase the number of people who would have access to our current justice system.
Thank you.
I'm happy to take questions, and I am also happy to stay until the end.
Thank you very much. Senator Whitsitt.
Dr. Burdick, sir, I perhaps take a little different view than you on this issue, but in a way it tends to extend the arm of lawyer to intimidation to $7,500. I think that it's not, would you agree that it's not uncommon that demand letters virtually always include a threat that the plaintiff's attorney fees will be charged to the defendant, and then usually offer to make a settlement out of court quickly to avoid these charges?
Well, in my experience, prior to the sending of the 10-day demand, the attorney is not entitled to any fees. And it's the waiting of the 10 days and the filing of the lawsuit which creates the right to those attorney's fees. So the attorney's fees up till then would be zero. With respect to the amount of the attorney's fees as a threat, there's cost of litigation on both sides of that coin. So defense counsel has the opportunity to evaluate a case and decide, is it worth spending our time and our resources defending a small case versus a plaintiff who may or may not be successful? I have oftentimes litigated cases in an effort to keep my hours to a minimum for something in the range of 10 hours, which may include an hour deposition of the plaintiff, an hour deposition of the defendant, the actual hearing itself that may take 2 to 3 hours, leaving 5 hours of work. So, you know, those are always costs of doing business, yes, and it does act as a hammer, yes. But I do not think that simply sending the current required 10-day demand notice gives rise to the right to attorney's fees, no.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Now we have the rare honor of having one of our own subject to grilling as a witness.
Straight
Senator
my time.
Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, take it easy on me, please.
For the record, I'm questions.
What's that?
I'm already ready to ask questions.
Okay. I'm State Senator Charlie Ringo, and I have arranged for this bill to be introduced, and I appreciate your taking the opportunity to hear it, Madam Chair. I think that Judge Albright hit the nail on the head when she said this is an access to justice bill. And it was already laid out. I guess I want to say it a little bit differently, but when there is a case with very large damages, then it's cost-efficient for an attorney to take that on a contingent fee basis, and it makes sense for a plaintiff to pay the attorney on an hourly rate to take that case. But when you have a case on very small damages, it's very difficult. And this bill was originally created to respond to this situation where there's a small damage case, and the defendant, and often but not always it's an insurance company, often it is, just refuses to take it seriously. They refuse to acknowledge that, A, it's a valid claim, or they refuse to acknowledge that there were damages. And you put yourself in that situation, what would you do? I mean, what would you do if somebody ran a red light, hit your car, caused $2,000 worth of damage to a vehicle, and the insurance company said, too bad, we're not going to pay? Now, it may be tempting for you to think, oh, that doesn't happen in the real world. Insurance companies don't act that way. But I guarantee you that often they do. They're not always abusive, but there are enough examples where insurance companies try to game the system. They look at somebody and they look at a situation where they know they're responsible, yet they don't care, and they refuse to step up to the plate. I've used this statute in my own practice on a number of occasions, and generally it is a successful tool to reach a quick and a fair result. One of the things that I did is I sent out an email to the trial lawyers on the trial lawyer listserv saying, colleagues, could you please send me examples where you used this statute successfully? And at the bottom of the first page, it says cases expedited through the use of 20.080, and there's four bullets. And then I've attached the emails, and there's what follows are three emails. The first email contains two examples. But these are very typical where... And let's just look at the first example. This is on the second page, the top of the second page. This is from an attorney in Roseburg. And the person at this intersection, it was just an intersection collision, not very large damages. The medical bills were $1,200. When they contacted the insurance company, the adjuster said, no, we're not going to pay. We're just not going to pay. What's the person to do? In this case, they were able to take advantage of 2080. They sent a letter. 5 days later, they got a quick offer, and it was a modest amount. I don't think this email says, well, the vehicle is worth $1,100, the medical bill is $1,200. So it was a modest result. But without that tool, there's no way this person could have received justice. This email contains another example, also from Roseburg, and in this case, there was an incident at a retail store where it sounds like somebody was run down by a big train of shopping carts. And again, modest damages, but they wouldn't return her phone calls, and they wouldn't offer to pay her medical bills. In this case, they sent the 10-day demand letter, and they still didn't get a response. Then the attorney filed a lawsuit, and they immediately got a call from the defense attorney saying, you're right, we're on the hook, and we're going to pay. And here the amounts aren't listed, but it was clearly a modest amount. The next page indicates where somebody had damages of a little more than $6,000 and actually had to scale back their demand to $5,500 to fit it within the confines of the statute because the $5,500 was a little bit too low. So that's an example where this statute, the current level of $5,500 was not enough. They raised it to $7,500 and it allowed the person to take the case. So it was a successful resolution.
Senator Ringo,
yes.
Do you know how long this 5,500 has been in effect?
You know, my very last chart has some of the data points on that.
Okay.
There's this graph. Oh,
okay.
Okay. I'll get there in a second, but let me talk to the let me mention this third email. The third email, this is an example, another relatively low-speed auto case, not large damages. Clear liability, apparently, but the insurance company said, well, we've hired an expert that says that this injury could not have occurred, and that expert never even consulted with the victim, never even saw the victim, and just said, well, based on our accident reconstruction, the G-forces were insufficient. It's just a ridiculous thing to do. Frankly, that's an abusive tactic by an insurance company to, without even taking the time to examine somebody, say, we know they could not have been hurt. So there was a 20.080 letter sent. This email says that they filed and served the complaint, and a few months later they settled for $4,000, a fairly modest amount, plus the medical bills were $4,000, And because they had had to file the suit, go through the first part of litigation, they paid $2,500 in attorney fees. These are just a few examples of the success of this statute. Now, Senator Burdick, you asked the amount, and actually it was handed to me here. If you look at this chart, and my legislative assistant put this together, and it's a little bit confusing, but if you start at the current level of $5,500 and back it out, you can see that. Okay, 1999 was when it was raised to $5,500. In 85, it was $4,000. In 1980, it was $3,000. So if you go along the top line to try to maintain the current value of where $5,500 is under adjusted for inflation, essentially it would be $6,680. That's what it would be in today's value if we start at the 1980 $3,000 level. So we're moving up from $5,500 to $7,500, which is a little bit above the $6,600 level, so that's keeping it a little bit ahead of inflation, but not too much. I know that there are a number of representatives of the insurance industry, and some of them are insurance defense lawyers who I'm friends with and I have a lot of respect for. And I suspect they'll say, well, this can be abused in some way, and that's certainly not the intent. In my experience, it is a very efficient way to resolve small claims, and it's my hope that this body passed this out of the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I don't know if this question is for Senator Ringo or for counsel. I'm trying to figure out exactly what Section 2 does. I mean, the first part of Section 2 says it applies to all causes, whether arising before, on, or after the effective date. And then Sub 2 says it doesn't apply to any causes that commence before the effective date. What does that mean?
I don't know what it does.
But
it means it's not retroactive, I think, is what the last part says.
That doesn't the first part say it is?
You mean?
I do. I think that's exactly, though, what it means. I think it means that if the cause of action arose before the effective date, but the claim had not been filed, then this would apply. If the cause of action arose before the effective date and the claim was filed before the effective date, this would not apply. It would be under the former.
So it's only retroactive if a claim hasn't been filed yet.
Correct.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not. Is it retroactive in any way? It doesn't seem to me that it is. It seems to me that this applies to accidents. Let's just use accidents that occur after the date that the statute becomes effective.
Yeah, because the first subsection says it applies to everything, on, before, or after. But then the second part says if the action was commenced before this goes into effect, then it's under the old statute.
Mm-hmm. So I think a cleaner way to explain it would be it applies to causes. It applies to claims made after January 1st, 2006.
Regardless of when the accident may have happened.
Well, there would still be the limit, at least, that the claim must have been within for an incident that happened within the statute of limitations. So it could relate back, certainly, a tort claim to whatever the applicable statute of limitations is before the effective date.
Follow-up then?
Follow-up.
So under that scenario, if someone has made a claim already and settled it, let's say for $5,500 or $5,495, if this passes with this language, could the person on the same cause of accident go back and file another claim for $2,000 more?
No, because more than likely they've already signed some type of release saying that they've given up any other additional claims based on that settlement from the first one in the first place. I mean, most insurance companies are not going to pay out unless there's some type of release given.
I think the better question might be if you filed a claim and it hasn't been adjudicated yet, whether you could drop it and file a new claim.
Okay. On that note. Does this only apply to insurance?
No.
So if a person, me as an employer, has received a demand letter for something and I paid out $5,400 without signing any kind of release or saying that
you know, there'd be no more cause of action on it. If this goes into effect, could I be subject for another $2,000?
That'd have to be the basis for the $2,000. I mean, if you, there's always a hypothetical, Senator, if you don't have a release that whatever else they want to complain about, let's say they didn't realize they had a back injury or soft tissue, whatever, and they came back, I think you could potentially have some liability, but they're going to have to be able to demonstrate it that it's above and beyond.
The other limitation that's written into the language of this bill is that, actually the language of the statute currently, is that it can only be based on an injury or wrong to person or property. So it is only a tort claim. The language of the current statute actually specifically excludes any action based on contract.
Does that clear it right up for you, Russ?
Pretty much.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Senator Ringo, thank you for your testimony, and believe me, I don't wish to get into a debate with an articulate attorney and senator, but having said that, could you conceive of the situation where a named potential defendant would settle a spacious claim to avoid the threat of attorney fees that might be equal or exceed the actual amount of small claims? And the threat obviously involves that the potential, at least, that the defendant would have to pay both his own and the plaintiff's attorney fees, which could very, in many instances, might exceed that claim. And when you leave the third party, the insurance agent, out of the equation, the insurance lawyer, you're talking about a private party, then it puts a tremendous hammer in the hand of the plaintiff's lawyer, doesn't it?
Well, it's a hammer, but I think it is useful to address the situation when it's necessary. I will tell you that I am defending a case right now where it's an auto repair case. My client operates an auto body shop and is being sued for doing defective work. And they brought this under 20.080. And it is a tool that we're very aware of. And frankly, it compelled us to make a quick offer. Because we recognized some exposure. So I just want to let you know that I can see this from both sides. The situation you mentioned, is it possible that somebody could be responsible for paying the plaintiff's attorney fees and the defendant's attorney fees? Could the defendant have to fall in that situation? The answer is yes, but that's only if it goes to some adjudication, either at arbitration or trial, and they're found to be liable. And so, yes, that is possible. The other part of your question was, could there be a specious claim? We'll call it a phony or trumped-up claim. You know, you read about these in the newspaper every now and then or see something on TV, and they always drive me nuts because it diminishes the stature of the legal profession and of our justice system. You know, they stub their toe and they sue for $1 million, that kind of thing, really gives a bad reputation to the whole system. I can tell you that is a long way from the reality of it. In Washington County, where I practice, the average auto case, the jury trial in the average auto case is less than $10,000. It really is small. I've had defense attorneys who won a case and walk away saying, gosh, I can't believe that the jury was so stingy to that person. So, and frankly, because of this, I think insurance companies generally do not reach quick settlements just because of the fear of a lawsuit. They have taken the position that overall it's best policy for them to defend them. Even if it's a frivolous lawsuit, they would rather spend $10,000 defending the lawsuit than pay $5,000 in essentially extortion money.
Okay, Senator Ringo, I think you're speaking for the insurance companies. We're about to hear from them,
okay.
And I have to throw you off to your other side of the table here because we're running out of time.
That is fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Ringo. John Powell and Steve Morrill will be next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, and with me is Steve Morrill, an attorney in their claims area. Steve's going to give you a few of the reasons why we oppose this increase. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, Steve Merle. I'm an attorney for State Farm Insurance. I'm employed by their claim department and give their claim department advice on legal issues. I'm in opposition, here in opposition today to Senate Bill 333 because of a number of reasons. Basically, it's the enlargement of the statute to $7,500, and I kind of want to give you some concept of what that will do if you make that policy choice. I had a special run of stats run for State Farm for the year 2004 to see, okay, how many claims do we have where we paid both bodily injury and property damage combined where it exceeded or was under $7,500? And basically, we had 19,000 claims in 2004 that involved both bodily injury and property damage. And of those, 82% of them would have fallen below the $7,500 in combined payments. So basically, by raising it to $7,500, the universe of claims that you're including is quite large. Most of the claims that we're going to be looking at are going to be subject to this statute. That does something that we're opposed to, which is it encourages litigation or encourages a hammer to be used to inflate claims. That comes back around that we all pay insurance premiums, and those costs are directly related to what we pay, and it will raise the cost of insurance. Another thing that you should be aware of how this statute is currently used is that it does not give you any credit for advance payments. That's significant because a large number of claims that we handle within State Farm will have a situation where liability is reasonably clear. The person will come to us, we'll go ahead and get the property damage evaluated, and we pay that property damage. That part of the claim is done, they're satisfied with it. If they then decide to go get representation because they're injured, and it's a fairly small injury, they can go ahead and make the demand for $7,500 for that injury alone because it's property damage, injury, or both. The case law as it has developed doesn't give you any credit. I may have paid $2,000 or $3,000 for that person's car repair, but now I'm looking at $7,500. Although my data run included combined payments for BI and PD, being bodily injury and property damage, if you looked at the claim when you're considering advanced payments, it would actually expand it greater. So we're looking at quite an expansion. One point that hasn't been made today that I would hope you'd all appreciate, too, is that this statute only allows for the plaintiff to get their fees. A defendant who successfully resists a non-meritorious claim still pays his attorney's fees, his court costs, and just walks away with the knowledge that they were right in saying that they didn't owe the claim or that the amount of the claim that they tendered was the right amount. Because you could have two situations where you would not owe fees. One is that there was no liability for the claim. You were completely right. You didn't owe anything. Or you could have tendered an amount within that 10 days that the plaintiff did not beat. And that happens quite often. We'll tender an amount within that 10 days. And sometimes that gets rejected. If you're successful in either saying, no, I wasn't responsible at all, or the amount you guessed was right, you get nothing. The plaintiff is the only one that can benefit from fees and provides just too much of an incentive to litigate. I know we're short on time. I'd be happy to answer questions if the committee has them.
Are there questions, Senator Pisanski?
Thank you. One part that threw me in your testimony was that if you make a payment out early on property, you're not getting a release that's going to waive any other claims brought against your insured.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pisanski, typically when we make property payments for cars, we are not taking releases. And the reason for that is you're usually getting an estimate of damage and the car has to be repaired. There can be so many things that happen where that estimate of damage then becomes larger in order to handle that claim efficiently and quickly to take care of a consumer. It's just too cumbersome to use a release.
One other question. If we were going to expand this to $7,500, if it required that both personal and property damage be brought forward within that time frame, would that change the position that Allstate has? In other words, where they wouldn't be able to bifurcate it, hit you for the property, then come back and try to hit you for personal?
Chair Burdick, Senator Pisanski, I think it would be helpful. I don't think it's probably the best solution that you could have.
Thank you.
Because I had the same, my ears perked up at that same thing, too. So you're saying under the existing statute, you've had the experience where you've paid out a claim and then someone comes back with you back on the $5,500?
Sure, Rick, that's correct. We will have those instances where we pay for the person's car, that issue is resolved, they decide to get an attorney, and now the statute is available for them to make the demand for the bodily injury and to start over again afresh with a full $5,500 under the current statute as it exists.
Because it seems to me that the whole purpose of this is places where the insurance company is being unresponsive. And
well, Madam Chair, I guess just to pitch in, I mean, let's take that example where you've got a situation and they do admit fault, and so they pay for the vehicle, but let's say they refuse to pay for the person's lost wages, or they refuse to pay for the medical expenses, or they refuse to pay for any of the non-economic damages. What are you going to do? They paid for the vehicle, but they're not stepping up to the plate and paying for other things that they legitimately should have to pay for. I don't think that's unfair.
Sure, but if I could respond to that, is that, you know, if you pay for the vehicle, you've decided you're responsible for it. I can't fathom a situation where you say, I'm not paying anything for the injury. It may be a matter of how much is that worth, is a more likely scenario.
Oh, I've seen many situations like that. Or let's just take lost wages. I've had too many situations where somebody is self-employed and they're not able to provide a statement from a supervisor saying that they make $2,500 a month. And the insurance company refuses to recognize any lost earnings, any. Because they say, no, we want to see 3 years' tax returns, we want to see W-2s, we want to see letter from employers. And they say, look, this person can't do that. They run a beauty salon. They don't have that.
Okay, I think we might just kind of move along here.
That's fine.
Are there other questions from the committee?
The IRS might have a question about that person.
Okay, thank you very much. Next we will take, in our remaining few minutes, Bill Sein from the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Sein. I am a lawyer in private practice here in Salem. I've been practicing for over 22 years, primarily in the defense of civil claims. I'm a member of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. I'm here on behalf of that organization. Not really taking a position for or against this particular bill, because all this particular bill does is it increases the threshold from $5,500 to $7,500. And that's going to be your prerogative where that increase is necessary. I think you need to ask yourself, is there some sort of empirical data to support the need for that? But our organization is not going to get involved in that debate. There is a purpose for this particular statute to encourage the settlement of meritorious claims. You know, a vast majority of these claims are settled before a lawsuit is filed. Once a lawsuit is filed, a vast majority of those cases get settled before they go to trial. But I tell you that there is a problem in the operation of this particular statute that should be addressed and looked at by this committee. And it was intended as a bill that's going to, again, encourage the settlement of claims, and the attorney fee provision there, or the threat of that, is something that does that. It does have that desired effect. But I have to tell you that there are many occasions that the attorney's fees becomes the tail that wags the dog. It is something that, because the threat is there and basically running up the fees, is something that prolongs the litigation and serves as an impediment or disincentive to getting a case settled. And there are many situations out there where, for example, after a jury trial, the award is relatively modest, say $2,000 or $3,000, and the person is legitimately entitled to recover attorney's fees under this statute, but you're seeing attorney fee awards of over $20,000 or $30,000. That threat is something that really gets the company's attentions or individuals' attentions. And I'm going to suggest that if that is something that is exposure that is out there, that there ought to be some additional procedural provisions that are put into place so an insurance company, once they get this written demand, can fairly evaluate a claim so they can put the best dollar offer out there to try to get the case settled. And in my written statement, I include, I think, three things that are going to be important to consider. One is the current statute, in order to serve as a trigger for the right to attorney's fees, requires that a written demand be given more than 10 days before the lawsuit is filed. In many situations, that is simply not enough time for an insurance company to evaluate a claim. Sometimes they don't even get the demand letter, which is sent to the defendant, the other driver, for example. They don't even get that letter until the 10 days has run and a lawsuit has already been filed. So I'm going to suggest that that 10-day period be extended to some reasonable time, 21 days or 30 days, or you pick what that number is, but give the insurance company time to receive the information to properly evaluate the claim so they can put their best dollar offer out there. I've seen personally situations where the demand letter, remember this right to recover attorney's fees is triggered by a written demand letter. The demand letter is essentially a one-liner that says something to this effect. My client's been injured and you need to pay $5,500 or else we'll sue and get our attorney's fees. With no supporting documentation, no indication as to even what the nature of the injury is. And how can a person receiving that sort of demand make some sort of evaluation of the claim? What I'm going to suggest is that the statute be amended to require that if there's a claim for personal injury involved, that some documentation support of that claim be provided with a demand letter. And it be in the nature of the doctor's bills and the doctor's medical chart that relates to that particular injury. So then the insurance company or defendant can have that, look at it, and evaluate, and then put the best dollar offer out there. Now, this puts the plaintiff at no disadvantage in no particular inconvenience because if lawsuit is filed, they're going to be required to produce that information later on. The order and rules of civil procedure require it. Why not get that information up front when it can be useful and used in selling a case? And the same thing for the property damage to the vehicle. Why not require the introduction of the repair estimates to go along with that letter or that demand? It seems to make sense. Give the information out there so that it can be used in evaluating the claim. It's going to be discovered anyway after the lawsuit is filed. Those are the only suggestions I have. I certainly would welcome any comments, and thank you for the opportunity to appear.
Thank you very much, Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the 3 points is, one, extend the time frame; two, have documentation; one, if there's personal injury to support that; and third, if it's personal property, such as the vehicle, any type of estimates for repairing it.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Sarah Brzezinski, I think in my written materials, one is to extend the time from 10 days to 30 days.
Right.
Require that the notice go to the defendant's insurance company also if the insurance company is known.
Okay.
And the next would be to require that that documentation be supported, included as a part of the written demand. And I've taken a stab at a draft, but you're welcome to use it or start it fresh.
Thank you for taking the time on this. Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How you doing, Billy?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Good to see you.
Thanks for visiting us. Madam Chair, I just want to comment. I don't think what Mr. Simon has mentioned is too unreasonable. I think certainly the 10 days, I'm flexible in talking about that because the point is not to trap insurance companies unreasonably. The point is to try to resolve claims. I don't think the second point is unreasonable, sending a copy to the insurance company. The third point, as far as sending copies of the medical records or vehicle damage estimate, I don't think that's unreasonable as long as it's not meant to be too encompassing so that, you know, somebody doesn't have one nurse's chart note from some visit somewhere and so that therefore they can't take advantage of the lawsuit. But Madam Chair, I'd be happy to work with Mr. Simon or anybody from the industry in addressing these issues.
Okay, and that would include the folks from the insurance side of it as well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you for coming. Are there other questions?
Oh, Madam Chair, I think the insurance folks just care about the amount. I don't think they're going to object to these changes either. But
I would think that if you could make the statute better for everyone without regard to the amount, that the raising the amount a little bit, which would certainly be justified by inflation if you were looking at the $5,500, what it was worth in 1999, that we might actually end up with a better statute in some ways for the insurance industry without regard to the amount. So I appreciate you coming. Thank you. We have two more insurance folks here, Lana Butterfield and Sean Miller. Yeah, I know. And we're not going to be able to get to you this time, but I want to invite you to participate in the discussions as we try to work our way through this. Thank you. And feel free to introduce any written testimony. Thank you. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 333. Oh, everybody pay attention. There has been a major development. We are going to the Supreme Court tomorrow for lunch. And I apologize for letting this slip by me. But we will, our annual or our session, regular session lunch with the Supreme Court is tomorrow. Senator Walker is carrying two bills on the Senate floor tomorrow, so we're going to try to make her talk fast, and then we will get over there. And if we are a little late, Senate Judiciary will convene a little late tomorrow.
And if I can make one other announcement.
Senator Kozanski has an announcement.
For those members who are on Senate Commerce, we'll be starting about 15 minutes after, since it's after 3. Give us a little bit more time to get down there. So 3:10, 3:15. 3:15 today.
Okay. Council reminds me that we have in our packets the rules for certification are changing, and I don't really understand it, but look at your packets. And with that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you, Dr. Charlie.